Good morning. I'm Doug Phillips, podcast editor for the American Journal of Neuroradiology, and we're here to discuss a new special collection for AJNR entitled Vascular Lesions of the Head and Neck Diagnosis and Intervention. The collection editor, Dr. Guillerme Debus, is with me this morning from the Miami Vascular Institute. He is one of the neuroradiologists and the director of the fellowship. He's an associate professor of radiology at Florida International University. Dr. Debus, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Doug. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
The special collections through AJNR has become an incredibly popular thing. Talk to us a little bit about the process when Dr. Castillo approached you to put this collection together.
Right. So basically, vascular anomalies in general of the head and neck, it's a very challenging set of diseases that nobody quite understands very well still its biological processes and even less like the way these lesions should be managed. From the perspective of an interventional neuroradiologist, we were discussing with Dr. Castillo and thought it would be interesting to maybe pull up some articles and see what exactly has AJNR to offer in terms of how to diagnose and manage these very challenging diseases. And I think it's a great topic since the role of the neuroradiologist in providing also like both a diagnosis as well as potentially treating these lesions is great, usually inserted on this multidisciplinary team, which usually consists of dermatologists and plastic surgeons, ENT surgeons, oral maxillary surgeons, sometimes vascular surgeons. So I think it would be a great chance, and it was flattened when Dr. Castillo actually asked me to do it, and I thought it was a great opportunity to see what is up there in AJNR.
I think one of the nice things in talking to other special collections editors is that not only did they get a chance to edit something very important for membership and for fellows, people in training, but also a chance to kind of get back in, dig around in the literature and see what's really been meaningful to you over time.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. And, doing this research, you find articles from the 80s that are still like so relevant up to now, like anatomy articles, geographic anatomy, and a lot of papers that before this, I didn't know. I haven't read them before, and I just thought it was amazing, just to have these articles available and now like putting them all together in this collection. I think it's really outstanding.
So in discussing this with you, you tell me that you've collected a few of your favorites and some items about each one of those. Why don't we just go ahead and talk about a few of those articles and tell us why you thought they were so important and what earned their inclusion in this collection?
Absolutely. It's my pleasure, actually. As the reader will notice, I actually split this collection in four sections. First section, which was basically discussing the vascular anomalies themselves, including hemangiomas and high and low flow vascular malformations. Section two is more just highly vascularized tumors of the head and neck, which mostly are like paragangliomas and juvenile nasal angiofibromas. Type 3 is actually something that is related to head and neck cancer, which is this very dangerous situation, which is called a carotid blowout syndrome, and how to really manage this issue. And then the section 4 is basically just a miscellaneous set of articles, which include one that's my favorite, and a couple of them in epistaxis and one in anatomy of the craniocervical vessels. Starting with the vascular, so I'm going to go by sections. I definitely selected some of them that I think they're very important. And from my perspective, being interventional neuroradiologist, they really will provide guidance, at least more information that we can discuss with the patients when we have these challenging situations. So the first one that I selected here is actually a very recent paper. It's called Head and Neck Arteriovenous Malformations, Results of Ethanosclerotherapy. And why I think this is important, because there's a lot of ways that this head and neck arteriovenous malformations, they can be treated. There are several different agents. Some are more aggressive, some are less aggressive. And I think the importance of this paper is that ethanol, which it's basically a medication that is extremely cheap, can actually provide a fairly high number of cure. And in this paper here, of all their patients, they achieve just treating with ethanol greater than 50% cure. And most of the patients, actually, of the 19 patients, 18 patients were cured or had significant relief of their symptoms, which are usually like functional impairment or cosmetic problems. However, the other thing that I think it's very important is the authors are very successful in pointing out that ethanol is probably of the sclerosing agents, symbolic agents, it's probably the most aggressive one to the tissue. So it's the ones that carry the highest chance of complications. And we encountered a pretty fair number of procedures, about like 14 procedures of all 59 treatments, they had complications related to the alcohol use. And most of them are pretty self-limited to skin necrosis or that didn't require any repair or mucosal necrosis. But, we know that complications from alcohol embolization, they can be pretty aggressive and morbid, including like cardiovascular collapse, pulmonary hypertension and everything. So I think that this is a good paper that shows the benefits and the risks of embolizing anything with ethanol. Another paper that describes this paper from Dr. Jacques Moret group in France, and actually it's like where they describe the combined approach in the vascular and surgical for treatment of palpebral arterial malformations. And why I think it's important, because everything that involves the orbit or its surroundings actually carries a very significant morbidity on treatment for functional impairment or blindness. And these lesions are usually very difficult to treat. From the endovascular perspective, a lot of them are supplied by the ophthalmic artery, which poses a lot of risks for going in transarterially trying to occlude these lesions. And I think this paper here is actually another point that is extremely important, that it shows when you have this small, localized arteriovenous malformation, like a high flow, the best chance of cure for these patients and the best chance of better functional outcome or cosmetic outcome is when these patients are embolized and then operated just after it. And they show that they can get very good results doing this combined approach. Another paper, and I think this paper actually is more just to show how this embolic agents, they can be safe and everything. And it is the paper that describes the safety and clinical efficacy of Onyx for embolization of extracranial head and neck vascular anomalies. And I think this is important because every time you have an embolic agent that's it's newer than the other ones, I think it's important to demonstrate that this embolic agent is safe and it's not going to cause the patient more problems doing it. The Onyx in general is an embolic agent. This is probably the safest one to use. It's very controllable. However, there are issues regarding this head and neck craniofacial EVMs, and one of them is that the Onyx is black. It has tantalum on it, tantalum powder. So there's always a lot of fear that you're going to have like stain the skin when you use the embolic agent. And actually this paper here is very successful in showing, and as well as like some other papers in the literature, showing that actually the chance of having stain on your skin from the Onyx, I mean, it's possible, but it's very, very uncommon. And it's interesting, the authors like pointed out that they think this may happen only when the AVM really involves the dermis itself. So I think that's an interesting paper, just showing that using the embolic agent in this kind of AVM, it's fairly safe.
So as an aside, with the papers that you've gone through to this point, where do we stand with interventional agents? The embolization agents have obviously progressed, and my fellowship included a fair amount of interventional, and at that time it was balloons and occasional alcohol and glue, which many people, you probably recall as well, would smuggle into the U.S. It was a product that had some questionable value and utilization at that time. So where are we with the embolization material?
So basically, when you're talking about the vascular malformations in general, okay, like if we're talking about specifically the high-flow vascular malformations, it's amazing. All these agents can still be used. So there are a lot of people, as I said, that have very good experience using transarterial or transvenous embolization or sclerotherapy, this is probably the better term, using alcohol for these lesions. And it's probably the one that results the highest chance of cure, but also is the one that's associated with more complications. So a lot of people who are not familiar with the agent or using it throughout their fellowship, they're kind of scared of using them. And there are reasons why they're scared. And so there are other embolic agents that are safer to use. And you know, we still use glue and nowadays Onyx, which are liquid embolic that basically transarterially or transvenous just go there and forms like a plug, or the cyanoacrylate, which is the glue, just polymerizes and basically closes off the AVM or the nidus or its branches. But still other agents can be used, not as frequent, but they still sometimes may have a role, for example, like PVA or embospheres, although they're not usually should be used, but in some cases when you think it's you're uncomfortable or you don't feel like you should use glue or Onyx, patient maybe that is bleeding or there's an epistaxis associated with it, you can still use that. But, you know, nowadays I would say that the main agents that you use for, like, treatment of vascular malformations are definitely like the liquid embolics, which would be the NBCA, which is glue, and Onyx, and alcohol. Alcohol still has an important role in it, because balloons provide just too proximal occlusion that really usually doesn't help.
Right. Any other papers in that section? Actually, the one that came to me as looking through is the FACES paper.
Yes,
is that syndrome, and it has been previously discussed on the podcast. It's I think it's critical for our members to recognize the disease and the chance association with neuroimaging studies, that they can actually make that call.
Absolutely. I mean, there's two papers, actually, that I think it's very interesting. And, you know, I put them together. One is the FACES one. And I think it's very important that we recognize when you have, like, patient with a segmental facial hemangioma, this patient should have MRI of the brain. On this paper that you described, the FACES Association, a neurologic review of 17 patients. Actually, interesting, the authors found that of all the patients that had CNS structural malformations, they had cerebrovascular abnormality, and that this cohort of patients was at a high risk for development or neurological problems, which it's pretty striking. And a lot of them actually had arteriogenesis or aneurysms or stenosis, which I thought was pretty interesting. But the other thing that actually struck me as interesting, and then I found another paper that revealed the same kind of findings, is that some of their patients also had, with subtentorial CNS anomalies, also had like cortical dysgenesis and migration abnormalities. And then there's another paper that is also in the collection, which is called Facial Hemangioma and Hemispheric Migration Disorder, which is the presentation of five patients that actually talks exactly about that. So that's another thing that's important. Some of these patients' faces, they may have migration disorder. So it's important to study them very well. They may have seizures and all this kind of other problems that migration disorders can cause. So I think those papers actually go together very well and really shows this patient should be well studied with MRI of the brain, MRA, to find out if they have those problems, because they can be seen. You know, we think about faces, and the first thing that people think about is like posterior fossa abnormality, but you also look for cortical migration problems, cortical dysplasias, arterial abnormalities, and it's very, very prevalent on this population.
Right.
The other two papers that I just want to mention very briefly here, Doug, are actually related to neuroimaging of these lesions. One is the one described hemangiomas and vascular malformations of the head and neck, MR characterization. Actually, this is a very good paper. Everybody should read it because it describes very well all the MR findings of these lesions. It's a very interesting paper. But the other one that I found is really, really interesting is the one that is from the Toronto group, which is called Percutaneous Sclerotherapy for Facial Venous Malformations, Subjective Clinical and Objective MR Imaging Follow-Up Results. Because actually in this paper, they found out a very interesting result. One is that they treated all these venous malformations in the facial region with bleomycin, which is a very good agent for that. And they found out of these 32 lesions that they treated, 11 had a significant improvement. 10 had only minor improvement, and 11 of them, actually one-third of them, had no change at all in the size when they were followed with MR imaging. So that shows that these lesions are actually, a lot of times we're treating them and the patients feel better, but a lot of times we're not really doing a lot really to the lesion itself. Maybe we're just improving symptomatically because we cause thrombosis of compartment and everything. None of these lesions on their series actually were ever cured. They are always residual lesions, even though it improved a lot on the MR. And the interesting thing about that is that even knowing that about one-third of the patients had no change in the volume of the lesion on the MR, and 10 patients, which is another third, had only minor improvement, when they're talking to the referring physicians and to the patients, almost all of them really thought that the lesion had improved. So I think it's a very interesting. There's definitely like a clinical, radiological dissociation, I think, in the findings and how people may perceive that. Another couple papers on the diagnostic part that I think is interesting is one that describes that patients with periorbital lymphatic malformations, this comes from the children's group in Boston, you know, actually a third of them may also have arteriovenous abnormalities intracranially. So they also, every time you have a patient with a lymphatic malformation around the orbit or in the orbital region, these patients also should be studied intracranially because, as I said, about one-third of these patients actually may have significant intracranial abnormalities.
In the next section of vascular tumors, any particular papers there stand out to you?
Yeah, actually, there are a couple of papers that I think they're just great, and a couple of them actually I think they have like historical significance. The first one is from Dr. Hasselink, Dr. Davis, and Dr. Taveras, you know, describing the selective arteriography of the glomus tympanico and jugulary tumors. The other one comes from Switzerland, from Dr. Valavanis. Those people were truly like pioneers in selective microcatheter angiography, and they did a superb job just describing the anatomy and some of the embolization techniques that were used at the time that are still like relevant now. It's just amazing to me how things almost 30 years later are still very, very similar. Even though that we have all the technology available and the imaging are way better, but you know, this is still like very similar. Also in the highly vascularized tumor section, there are a couple of other papers. I think one is very important, is this, the ones that describe actually the direct embolic agent administration for this tumor. So basically, percutaneously, you just put a needle, you know, you find out, you localize the tumor with any kind of imaging assistance, with angiogram, with CT, and you basically directly puncture, and then using fluoroscopy, you just inject the embolic agent directly from the needle, and this actually provides great results. It's very easy to do and is in a very controllable manner, it actually provides very, very good devascularization of the tumors, way better than doing transarterially most of the time. One of the papers here actually described its complications using this technique in a large series of patients, of 65 patients. And it's really amazing that doing this, the chance of complications is small. And that's why it's important for us to understand really the anatomy in that location, all the collateral pathways, the external to internal collaterals, because the complications, when they do happen, are most of the time related to that. It's basically, or, you know, because the embolic agent went through a collateral and closed the ophthalmic artery, or went to the internal carotid artery, or sometimes using just these pathways, they cause cranial nerve problems, because a lot of times the external branch will supply the cranial nerves close to the skull base.
The carotid blowout syndrome papers, obviously a horrific problem.
Right.
Head and neck cancer. Any particular one paper in that section?
Yes. There's one paper, one of the initial papers, actually, the one from Dr. Chalupka and Dr. Putman. They actually described a very early description of the endovascular therapy for the carotid blowout in the head and neck. And interestingly, they provide three subgroups for these patients, which I think is very, very interesting, because this may have different, at least in the timing of when the lesions should be treated. And actually, they describe the first group, which they call like a threatened carotid blowout, is the group where the patient had head and neck cancer, radiation, everything. You have the breakdown of a wound. However, you see the carotid exposed, but this patient never had any bleeding or anything from that. So they call this a threatened carotid blowout, because this may happen at any time if the lesion, or at least the round lesion, is not covered with healthy tissue. The second group, actually, which is probably one of the most common and one of the most concerning, they call it the impending carotid blowout. So what that means is that it's a patient with the carotid blowout, which actually experienced a very short acute hemorrhage that resolved spontaneously or with very simple packing. So this patient is at a very high risk that the bleeding may recur and happen again. So this patient needs to be managed almost like as a true like urgency. And the final one is the really emergency is when the carotid just starts to bleed and cannot be stopped with anything. These patients, they have, of course, the worst prognosis, and they need to be managed emergently and just have this carotid. Or close, which is how they described initially, just go there and you sacrifice the carotid. Or nowadays, we have the options of covered stents, which they're not perfect and they have issues. And there are a couple of papers in this session that describe their advantages and their problems related to them. But they're a good, valid option, which is usually very quick. You just position it and it immediately seals the artery, at least initially. So those were the important papers, I think, in this section, for sure.
So, you know, in the final section, that includes a paper, which, as you and I described earlier, it's literally a paper that I, during my fellowship, had rolled up in my pocket, carrying around with me most of the time to review whenever I had a moment, a famous paper by Dr. Russell, The Functional Angiography of the Head and Neck. And you have a little bit of history of that paper as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, this, first of all, like, this is such a great paper. I mean, you know, anatomy is anatomy, so it's still very relevant. And actually, I have a couple of the original copies with me, which Dr. Russell was kind enough to provide me when I started my first job as an attending at Northwestern. And I looked at this paper and looked at it, and I still looked at it. I mean, it's just amazing. It's such a great description of cranial nerve supply and anastomosis in the skull base and what is important with functional angiography of the head and neck. I think anyone that want to understand head and neck embolization as well as the intracranial collaterals or extra to intracranial collaterals and ophthalmic supply, I mean, it's obligatory to read this article and probably have a copy on your pocket, you know, at all times, because it's just an amazing paper. It's just unbelievable. It's a great job
by a great guy,
which is Dr. Russell.
Absolutely. I could only agree. In closing, any remarks, anything that we haven't talked about that you think is important in this collection?
I think one of the messages of this collection is that there are several ways to really treat these lesions, and there are several embolic agents, sclerotherapy. Imaging-wise, all these patients should be imaged before making any decision. These patients, a lot of them will require an MRI for the vascular anomalies. Patients with carotid blowout, I think it's very important to have a CTA so you can kind of a little bit plan where the lesion is and how you're going to approach it. And I think the important thing also is that it's very important that as a neuroradiologist, we basically work together with the other specialties to really provide the optimal care for these patients, which a lot of times it's not an easy job, and it's not really like a one-man show. The more people involved, the better the chance of these patients having a good outcome. And in the end, you know, being a physician, that's really what is important.
Very well stated. Dr. DeBus, pleasure to have you with us in the special collection again, entitled Vascular Lesions of the Head and Neck Diagnosis and Intervention, and find it through the website. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Doug. It was a pleasure.
For the American Journal of Neuroradiology, I'm Doug Phillips, the podcast editor. We'll talk to you again next month.